This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. Today we're talking about a book coming out this fall called Who Got the Camera? A History of Rap and Reality, written by an Indiana native and PhD graduate of Indiana University. With us now is Eric Harvey, Associate Professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this this book that you've got coming out. How did you come up with this idea to merge the topic of late 80s and 90s hip hop with the early days of reality TV?
So I was at Indiana University. I was studying ethnomusicology, and it was about 2008, and I was looking for sort of a way in to think about this moment in popular culture history that I was a teenager during. It was for a course taught by Portia Maltby, Dr. Maltby, in it's titled The Perspectives on African-American Culture. And so I kind of went back to this period and started doing a little bit of research about sort of the late 1980s, early 1990s rise of hip hop to pop status. This is when hip hop kind of crossed over to the mainstream. And it also crossed over to the op-ed pages kind of at the same time. And as I was looking into it, I started noticing that a lot of these rappers, so rappers like Ice-T and Ice Cube and members of N.W.A., so on, would refer to it not as gangster rap, which is kind of what the media like to call it, but they would call it reality rap. And I was sort of taken by that description, and, you know, sort of the semantics kicked in, and I was like, oh, wait a minute. This was kind of the same time that reality television, as we kind of think of it now, had its sort of first wave, as I would later understand it. This was the moment when the show Cops started on Fox, and also America's Most Wanted. And then some other shows. This was the big kind of moment of daytime talk shows, Donahue, Oprah, et cetera. And then sort of the evening tabloid programs like A Current Affair and Inside Edition. And the more I looked into it, the more I sort of found that rappers at this moment were using their platform for a very similar kind of purpose as reality television producers were. It's kind of twofold. One is to kind of provide a soapbox to kind of air grievances, sort of like a daytime talk show. And the other one was to provide this proximity, the sort of closeness to the action that a show like Cops did. And, you know, after I kind of noticed those connections, it sort of seemed odd to me that for all the amount of coverage that this era of hip hop has received, rightfully so, it was a massive era. This connection had never really been made. And then from then, it kind of took off from there.
Well, it's interesting as you talk about how rappers were using this as a platform and they were calling it reality rap. It makes me wonder, you know, was this a way to get around the gatekeepers of media companies? You know, otherwise their stories wouldn't be out there.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. One of the biggest enemies on record of these rappers, apart from obviously with NWA, kind of the biggest enemy is the police. But, you know, one of the other big enemies here was sort of the mainstream media system. And so you would hear on Public Enemy records and NWA records and Ice-T records, you would hear constant, and Ice Cube, you would hear constant insults against mainstream black radio, who would avoid this kind of music like the plague because it, you know, was obviously very vulgar. They realized, you know, pretty quickly, you know, this was obviously the era that the CD took off and that they could actually, you know, do an end around. Even though somebody like Chuck D was saying, you know, rap is Black America's TV station, they were using a different medium for a similar purpose. They knew that if kids, teenagers or adults bought these records, threw them in their Walkmans, they could get these messages, these very entertaining messages in a way that, again, like you said, sort of bypassed the cultural gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm. You said Walkman. You took me back to like my childhood.
Yeah. Same here.
There weren't even Bluetooth headphones, folks. You just had to plug those things in and they were big and clunky. But, you know, I'm wondering also about, we're talking here a little bit about reality TV. And I think for folks in the present right now thinking about reality TV, they'll think of things like Survivor or Big Brother and stuff like that. What was reality TV like for the era that you are looking at in particular? And how is it different from what folks might think of as reality TV today?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I think a lot of people when they and rightfully so, this is not me kind of saying that people are wrong when they talk about reality TV as Survivor and Big Brother, which was really kind of, you know, 2000 onward, this massive kind of cultural phenomenon that, you know, continues today. But if you look into the history, if you look into what broadcasting journals were writing about and sort of the documentation that folks in television were talking about, it really started in the early 1980s and mid 1980s when they were noticing that networks were increasingly optioning shows that weren't news and they weren't entertainment. They were somewhere in the middle. They had real people on them. Some of us older folks might remember a show called Real People that was very popular in the 1980s. There have been people who have argued that Real People is really the sort of quintessential first reality show. But they started calling this stuff reality because they didn't really have a name for it in the TV vernacular. Again, it wasn't news and it wasn't entertainment. Now, you know, in 2021, you know, we see this incredible kind of infiltration of news and entertainment. We're kind of used to it by now. But back in the 80s, it was still kind of the old guard of what some people call the high modernist journalism. Very serious, very kind of, you know, old white men telling you what is important. And so there was this sort of, you could call it kind of a democratization of journalism in the 1980s. Obviously, as we all know, this is when CNN kind of popped up on cable networks. And it's when I think, and when talk shows came up, which were, this was all dealing with public affairs content, but it was doing it in a way that was not only kind of entertaining and light. You know, this is the time when, you know, you started having UFO witnesses kind of pop up on the news a lot and sort of these kind of quote unquote fringe characters. But it was also a little bit more populist than the news had been in the past. Again, this was the kind of news that wasn't emanating from the corridors of power. This wasn't emanating from DC, but it was coming from throughout the country. And it was, you know, it was obviously very popular. And so, that's when you started seeing and then it started leaking into the mainstream television press in the late 80s was this term reality television. And, you know, when Cops and America's Most Wanted hit the air on Fox, you know, Fox being the fourth network, the kind of, you know, the upstart in the late 80s, they had a lot of leeway. They had a lot of latitude to program this sort of more edgy material. And then, you know, that was when it really kind of locked in. And then, you know, the way that kind of history works is, you know, that was this moment, you know, from really I date it from like 86 until 96 in the book, for various reasons, but, you know, it was sort of eclipsed, you know, by Survivor and, Big Brother and everything, you know, the competition shows and then the really kind of celebrity driven shows, which mm-hmm. is what we kind of know reality as now.
Right. And speaking of the date that you have in the book, 86 to 96, what made you choose that specific time frame?
So 86 was really interesting to me because a lot of things happened in 1986. So in the television world, that's the year that Oprah Winfrey took her show national. It's the year that Geraldo Rivera signed a syndication agreement for his television show. It's the year that Rupert Murdoch bought Fox. And so television was changing a lot. And then obviously at the same time, this was cable television was on the upswing. You had satellite, you had CNN, you had MTV, you know, the television landscape was changing. Obviously you also had camcorders, which play a big role in the book as well. 86 was also a huge year in hip hop. I think an underappreciated year in hip hop. That was the year that Run DMC released the album Raising Hell, which was the first hip hop album to go double platinum. And it was also the first time that hip hop really kind of crossed over to rock audiences. So a lot of listeners remember the song Walk This Way, which was the Run DMC's collaboration with Aerosmith. 86 was also the year that the digital sampler was really making strong inroads into hip hop production suites, which allowed producers the ability to make rap beats that didn't necessarily have to play to the clubs. It didn't have to play to the barbecues. It could play to the headphones. And so sampling became a lot more nuanced, and rap beats became a lot more, in my view, interesting. And so this was Public Enemy. The rap group Public Enemy released their first album or first single in 1986. And of course, their production team, known as the Bomb Squad, really used the digital sampler better than in some views, any group ever, any producers ever. And so hip hop was changing dramatically. 86 was also the year that the group The Beastie Boys came out and brought hip hop to white audiences and rock audiences as well. And so I find that to be a really interesting point. And then 10 years later in 96, 96 was the, so perhaps the biggest kind of avatar of reality rap is Tupac Shakur, RIP. Tupac Shakur was, as we know, gunned down Vegas in late 1996. And the one outlet that really kind of broke the earliest news on this story was America's Most Wanted, which was hosted by John Walsh. It was sort of viewer participation, call this 1-800 number. And they went to Las Vegas, and they were the first ones to get the surveillance tapes from the casino. And so I found that to be a very interesting thing. Hip hop really changed after Tupac was killed and Notorious B.I.G. the following March. It kind of went in a different direction toward Jay-Z and Puff Daddy. 96 was also the year, 95, 96. That was when Phil Donahue hung up his mic. It was the year that Rupert Murdoch launched Fox News. So a lot of things, it felt good. You know, a book like this can get unwieldy. And I felt that it was useful and historically significant to limit it to this 10-year period.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're definitely going to delve more into that in a couple of moments. But just you mentioning Tupac and Notorious B.I.G. and all that stuff, Puff Daddy, it's just bringing me back to my teen years when I was discovering that music. And it was fascinating to me. But we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with the author of the book, Who Got the Camera? A History of Rap and Reality, which comes out this fall. Just a reminder, if you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about American culture in the late 80s and 1990s, particularly the emergence of raw, authentic rap music and the early days of reality television. We're joined by the author of an upcoming book on that very topic. Eric Harvey is an Indiana native who's now an associate professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. Eric, I want to ask you if you can give us a little bit of historical context. We can go back to the early 70s when rap music and hip hop culture started forming. Can you give us a little background on what that looked like?
Right. So if you look back at this moment, this was sort of the peak of the Black Power movement. When you think of the term soul, this was a moment when this idea was sort of congealing in Black communities and in popular culture together. And you know, this was, we all know the end of the 60s was a very, very heated time in terms of American politics and American cultural politics. And, so you had the assassination of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Then you have the kind of, around that same time, you had the Watts uprising and similar uprisings around the country. And, Black popular music was, during the 60s, you had Motown and Stax, and you had a lot of kind of crossover Black popular music superstars. And a lot of these folks, Marvin Gaye, Isaac Hayes, Curtis Mayfield, Aretha Franklin, and so on, Nina Simone, started incorporating kind of social commentary into their music. And so you get things like What's Going On and Superfly and albums like this. And at the same time, sort of a little bit more on the fringes, you had artists like Gil Scott-Heron out of New York City, who was a poet who started kind of setting some of this poetry to kind of very sparse production and eventually more jazz-leaning production. Gil Scott-Heron, who we know is responsible for the great phrase, the revolution will not be televised. And at the same time, you had the Watts Prophets, you had the Last Poets. A lot of these groups were really doing sort of oral poetry sort of to a beat and really laying the groundwork and talking about content-wise, like, what does it take? What will it take for African-Americans, for Black Americans to really kind of reach the status that they deserve in American society? It looks like the 60s have failed. You know, what's next? What can we do? And so music sort of became a platform for that. And this is right around the same time in the Bronx where, you know, DJs like Kool Herc were throwing their first block parties. You know, Kool Herc was not an expressly political guy. He was a DJ. You know, the roots of hip hop were kind of congealing there as well. And so really by the end of the 1970s, you had the full foundation, the full framework of what we would later call hip hop.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke a bit about gangster rap and how people were confusing, or at least the media was labeling it gangster rap. Is there a difference, or was that just the media term?
So it's interesting, right? So NWA, they both embraced the moniker and they kept it at an arm's distance. So, you know, NWA had a song called Gangsta, right? And this was a single that they released and they referred to themselves in their song called as a gang called We Know the Rest. And so they did that because, I mean, this plays into a lengthy history of rock and roll rebellion and popular music as sort of an outsider medium. And to be sure, NWA were total outsiders at the time that they broke through. This was not born in the center of the music industry. They were soon there, but they did it of their own volition. But the heart and soul behind NWA, for my money, is Ice Cube. Ice Cube, I think, is one of the most underrated, even though everybody knows his name today, I think he's one of the most underappreciated rappers to ever do it. And he was the brains, really, behind NWA. And he's the one who comes out and says, you know, it's about more than you know, sort of the vulgar street stuff. This is he referred to hip-hop as a network of information. Which I think is a really interesting way of thinking about it. You know, this is how for rappers, he said, you know, rappers like Ice Cube, he says, oh, this is how I learn about what's going on with people like me in Houston through the Ghetto Boys. This is what I learn about what's going on with folks like me in New York, in Long Island, or in New York from Public Enemy and Eric B. and Rakim, rappers like that. And so Ice Cube kind of was doing with rap by merging entertainment and information. He was really kind of leading hip hop along with Chuck D and Ice-T. He was leading hip hop in the same direction that journalism itself was going, which was this merger of entertainment and information.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to note that, I mean, for folks who are listening, who may not remember these days, there was no cell phone and internet at this time. This seems like the most ingenious way to sort of have communication across the country.
Yeah, I feel like it, you know, when Chuck D said rap is Black America's TV station, right? And he said that in 1988, if he would have said that in 2008, you know, it would have been rap is, you know, Black America's social media, et cetera. But at the time, I think television was really this medium that had a powerful hold on the imagination in terms of what it could accomplish in bringing America together and presenting them information and kind of reaching a mass audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. We're speaking with Eric Harvey, an Indiana native who's now an associate professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan, who has an upcoming book about American culture in the late 80s and 90s when it comes to rap and reality television. Eric, when we talk about gangster rap or folks that wanted to label it as such, what was the music usually about?
Well, that's a great question. It's about a lot of stuff. And so there's the content that really sort of angered a lot of people and worried a lot of people was the stuff that dealt with sex and violence, which, you know, the rappers would say, look, this is the culture of the streets. This is the culture of, you know, for NWA and Ice-T, this is the culture of Black Los Angeles. You know, you made it, and now we're reflecting it back to you. You know, and so there's no denying that a lot of the content on these albums is what you would maybe call like the disreputable pleasure, right? Which is the same kind of pleasure, don't get me wrong, that you're getting by watching kind of tawdry, you know, Amy Fisher stories, Joey Buttafuoco, kind of at the similar time on you know, the national news networks. And so, so yes, a lot of this content is profoundly misogynist. It's sort of, you know, lashing out at perceived enemies, which, you know, are kind of street rivals, police, and, you know, women who don't know their proper place, according to a lot of them. And so a lot of that stuff is prevalent. But there's what I would call a pedagogical aspect to this music too. There's so much to learn, you know, about, Black popular culture and about, Black history. I mean, you know, I write in the book a little bit about how, in the preface about how I learned that, you know, this was where I learned about, you know, hip hop records were where I learned about the Black Panthers. It was where I learned about who Marcus Garvey was. It made me, you know, I had to go to the library at the time and look up what COINTELPRO was, because I was, you know, hearing about this stuff on these albums. And so it was this, that was the other kind of part of this music, you know. So when you listen to, especially Ice Cube's solo albums, you listen to Public Enemy's albums. I mean, Public Enemy, this is, you know, one of the big reasons why Louis Farrakhan became such a prominent figure to a generation of young people was Chuck D from Public Enemy was putting him on Public Enemy records. And so, yeah, it was this sort of mixture of you know, the kind of prurient content mixed with sort of righteous indignation and a little bit of history that none of us were getting in schools at the time, like far from it.
So it was keeping it real before these changes in education, where they're like, we're actually going to start teaching you guys what really happened.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Totally.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to the different roles that early 90s rap music played, what was it like for the Black community at that time? Was this a way to, again, get the voices out there?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm, of course, you know, full disclosure, you know, I'm speaking about this music as an eavesdropper. I grew up, you know, in the suburbs of Indianapolis, you know, in the 80s and 90s. And so I can't, you know, directly speak, you know, to the Black community's experience, but just reading, you know, writing this book, I was reading, I read all the biographies that are available about these rappers, and I kind of dove into the literature. And again, I you know, I do think that it served. I mean, it was a massive entertainment product. It kind of reorganized the music industry in a lot of important ways. But it was also an important network of information, especially for African Americans who were for decades shut out of major media coverage, who had problems with the police, who had problems with redlining, and you know, so many other economic problems that, you know, this was one pipeline. This was a way to kind of get their voices heard.
Absolutely. Well, I do want to take a look at an example, or a listen, I should say, of a time when hip-hop culture and reality TV came together in a literal sense. A panel of musicians and social commentators appeared in a 1990 episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show to talk about controversial lyrics and imagery in popular rap and punk music. You highlight this episode in your book, and we're going to listen to a couple of clips from the show. First, here's Juan Williams, writer for The Washington Post. Let's take a listen.
The way we do music today, especially with Walkmans, as you said, as you started the show, a lot of times parents aren't aware what the kids are listening to. The kids are listening, tuned in to certain things, hearing these lyrics, responding to them, thinking of them as really anthems for their generation and their sort of rebellion, and tapping into all the hatred and resentments these kids have. And that's the way the music industry today seems to be feeding off of it, making money off of those instincts, rather than, if you think back to the 60s, the instincts about peace, love, and live together.
Eric, is this a common kind of commentary artists were getting at the time?
Yeah, I think, you know, Juan Williams was coming from a perspective when he was kind of looking at an era, you know, the late 60s, as I was kind of talking about earlier, when music was engaging with social realities in a way that was, you know, at times, you know, deeply resonant, but it was also kind of safe for airplay. And yeah, I mean, you know, if you grew up in the 60s and you were of a certain, I mean, by the way, all these rappers who I talk about in the book were either born in the 60s or very early 70s. And so these folks grew up kind of after the civil rights era in the 70s when things were a lot more muddled in terms of kind of, you know, where the where Black America was headed. And yeah, I mean, there's, you know, in a real sense, you know, you have somebody like Juan Williams, who's sort of a moderate political commentator, still around. He was at Fox News for a while. You know, of course, they're going to look at something like Ice-T. I mean, Ice-T had just released his album, The Iceberg, right before this episode aired. And oh, yeah, this was one of the most vulgar albums to ever see wide release. And so they dialed in not on the content, not on the kind of cultural context that kind of spurs this music, but they dialed in specifically just on like the bad words.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, another guest on this episode of Oprah was one of the originators of West Coast gangster rap, Ice-T, as you mentioned. Here's what he had to say in response to Juan and to the critics of his lyrics. Let's take a listen.
Don, I don't have evil intent. I just make records in the format that, you know, me and my homeboys talk, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I mean, what I say on that record, what you heard, I didn't hear anything different than that in the movie Harlem Nights or anything. What I do is I bring out how brothers on the corner talk. Now, I might be wrong, but I can't talk any other way than I know how to talk. If I had grew up like Brian Gumbel, I'd rap like Brian Gumbel.
So what does this argument from Ice-T tell us about the cultural dividing point you're looking into?
So I think that when you talk about, and Ice-T was really one of the earliest people, he's written about this several times, and he's written a couple books, and where he's a big proponent of the phrase reality rap. And he actually says he uses the phrase faction as well, too, to blend fact and fiction, which is a little bit harder to it's got some synonyms. But anyway, he is a big proponent of saying, look, there is as small of a barrier as possible between what I put on wax, what I am recording in the studio, and what I am either overhearing or talking about with my friends when we're hanging out. And this is really the same promise that is made by documentary filmmakers. This is the same promise that is made by the kind of local news outlets who say live, local, late breaking. And, you know, stands a reporter in front of, you know, some kind of event that's happening, is you're getting sort of the vox populi. You're getting the voice of the street, but not the voice of the street that the kind of mainstream news wants you to hear, but the voice that you're never going to hear unless you kind of take a trip to these neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting that he's mentioning that. And I'm surprised, like, this was from so long ago that they're speaking like this and come to today. And I feel like there's been a little bit more leeway in some of the lyrics and popular music and even movies and things like that. But Ice-T mentions a movie in that clip. And it's an argument that's often come up. Harsh language and imagery has long been accepted and even celebrated in movies, but is criticized when it shows up in music.
Right. Yeah. 1990 was a huge moment for this, too, which is when this episode aired. 1990 was the year that the MPAA changed the X rating to NC-17 because X was just, you know, impossible to release a movie. So NC-17 felt a little softer. So a lot of people were dealing with sort of the role of obscenity and vulgarity in American society at this moment. Some of your listeners may remember this was the big Robert Mapplethorpe moral panic. Robert Mapplethorpe was displaying some photographs at a gallery in Cincinnati, and that kind of erupted into this kind of moral panic about art and obscenity. This was the heyday of comedians like Andrew Dice Clay, you know, proudly vulgar, not censored at all to the extent that rappers were. You know, this was really the moment, you know, it was kind of America's existential foes had been vanquished, quote unquote, with the fall of communism. And it really felt for a whole decade that America was kind of turning on itself and fighting with itself, and vulgarity and obscenity and all of these moral panics really kind of rose to the forefront.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking now with social media and the internet, it's like anything is possible out there now. So it's hard to censor anything. But we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with Eric Harvey, author of the upcoming book, Who Got the Camera? A History of Rap and Reality, about the explosive popularity of rap music and reality TV in the late 80s and 1990s. If you have questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing hip-hop in the late 80s and 90s with an author whose new book makes connections between authentic rap music and the dawn of reality television. With us is Eric Harvey, a PhD graduate of Indiana University and an associate professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. Eric, when we talk about censorship, you know, there has to be some discussion about the controversies surrounding rap music and if it had any impact on the music industry. Did this create any more buzz about music in general being censored?
Yeah, I think, you know, if we look back now with the benefit of hindsight, I think that the big sort of censorship moral panic in the early 1990s was more promotional. I think the effect was more promotional for hip hop than anything else. I think that, and rappers would say this too, it's like, oh no, please, you know, put my music on your television show, or kind of wave around my album cover, like, which is what Tipper Gore would used to like to do. You know, wave around my album cover on the nightly news, and I will thank you for the free promotion. I think there really was this sort of moment where, you know, sociologists call them moral entrepreneurs. So Tipper Gore, Jack Thompson, folks like that. We're keenly interested in sort of boosting their own public profiles by, you know, sort of going after who they thought had the least amount of social power in America at the time, which was, you know, kind of prominent or semi-prominent African-American entertainers, people who they would see as low-lying fruits. Like, of course, I can go after these folks who, you know, how are they going to defend themselves? And they realized that not only were these young men and women, mostly men, able to defend themselves robustly, but that it made their albums sell in the millions. You know, the controversy was only promotional. Just want to bring up quickly, so there's a part in the book about Two Live Crew, who no one would accuse of being as politically informed as Ice Cube or Chuck D. Luther Campbell's an incredibly intelligent guy, but they're they were sort of they're very popular in the South in the late 80s until Jack Thompson, who was a Florida lawyer, went after video games as well, kind of went after Two Live Crew, made them superstars. And then they were kind of Jack Thompson and Luther Campbell had this famous duel on Donahue where they were kind of going back and forth with each other. And it was, you know, fascinating stuff. It's available on YouTube if you want to look it up. But this made Two Live Crew, first off, they, you know, their case made them First Amendment icons. And then it also got them a deal. They were their album after the controversial one was distributed by Atlantic Records. They were, you know, again, they were more famous than they ever were before. And so, I mean, nowadays, as you mentioned, with the internet, it's, you know, it's next to impossible to kind of stop this, this kind of stuff from reaching the people it needs to. But at the time, you know, when we were in a different sort of media environment, you know, it was capable to be at once kind of mortified at the idea that this music would be effectively censored, and also kind of like, well, it's helping them out promotionally as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think if you tell a lot of young people back in those days, you know, you can't listen to this, they're going to listen to it. They're going to go buy it.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I do remember, you know, I was going to ask you about Tipper Gore because I have this vague memory. Again, I was like a teenager, a young teenager at the time. And I remember something about Tipper Gore and like the Mothers or something about music. And they were trying to put label. Was it the explicit lyrics warnings on CDs? Is that what they were trying to do?
Exactly. Yeah. So Tipper Gore and Susan Baker, who was at the time the wife of Secretary of the Treasury James Baker, and some other folks in and around sort of the Washington power centers, the kind of centrist, conservatives, formed what they called the Parents Music Resource Center. And so the PMRC was basically, so they formed this in 85. And so some of your listeners might be able to Google Dee Snider, who is the lead singer of Twisted Sister. He testified at a congressional hearing that the PMRC essentially put on, and it was pretty funny. Frank Zappa also testified. John Denver, for some reason, testified. But the PMRC was really this lobbying group who was participating in this larger discourse during the 80s. So remember the 80s, right? This was kind of the rise of or really the establishment of what we know as modern conservatism, kind of, you know, merging almost imperceptibly with the rise of the religious right. So folks like Jerry Falwell, Ralph Reed, et cetera, were becoming incredibly powerful at this point. And the PMRC kind of fit in there. You know, Tipper Gore could call herself a Democrat, right? She's the wife of Al Gore. But essentially what she was wanting to do, she released a book. She was really appealing to suburban families and saying, you know, do you want these toxins coming into your children's ears through their Walkman headphones, right? Imagine what is happening that you don't know. She wrote a book in 1987 called Raising PG Kids in an X-Rated Society. And this book was Tipper Gore's kind of manifesto, saying she really at first focused on what she called porn rock, which incorporated everything from sort of, you know, heavy metal to Prince. It really had a wide ambit. And so, you know, this was Tipper Gore's way of, you know, making herself a public figure. You know, it was her way of kind of establishing herself in the public sphere. So, she really is sort of the point person when you talk about cultural censorship in the 1980s and 1990s.
Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to know what she thought about streaming platforms now, which don't censor anything.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to hear what Tipper has to say. Tipper's like she's a drummer in a band. So yeah, who knows? Maybe she's on Spotify. I'm not sure.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Fun fact.
Yeah. Well, if you're listening live right now, we'd love to hear your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Before we get into a discussion around the debates of free speech, I'm curious about your story, because I did read from part of the book, and you mentioned that you were an eavesdropper growing up, and you learned a lot through the music. What compelled you to continue and actually write a whole book about this?
Yeah. So going back to when I was – so again, I was born in 1977, Indianapolis, and I grew up in Indy, and, you know, was as I was kind of coming of age, became a teenager, this music was, I mean, you know, I was 13 in 1990, and so this stuff was everywhere. And I was attending Franklin Central High School, shout out to the Flashes. And I was, Franklin Central High School had been quote unquote desegregated, in 1971. It was sort of this long, or was part of a 1971, court decision, really started busing students, black students from downtown out to the burbs in 1981. And so when I was at Franklin Central, it was this interesting mix of black kids who were doing 45-minute bus rides each way to get to school, and then, you know, white kids like me. And so I was, you know, I was circulating. I was friendly with a lot of African Americans, where in my suburban home life would never, you know, they weren't quote unquote allowed to live in these areas. They were kind of redlined out of these areas. And so that really had an effect on me when I was growing up. So I was eavesdropping on these cultural conversations as a kid, listening to rap albums, watching Yo MTV Raps, et cetera, watching stuff like Fresh Prince, Living Color, Def Comedy Jam, all these shows allowed, you know, curious white onlookers to kind of learn a lot about black lives. And not everything, obviously, right? This is entertainment. But at the same time, I think it was important. It was kind of a cross-cultural conversation that was going on. At the same time, my dad was a cop. My dad was a Marion County sheriff. And so I grew up, I was always hanging out downtown Alabama Street. You know, my dad worked at the jail. And you know, I grew up around cops. I grew up, you know, hanging out at the FOP, you know, and immersed in cop culture. My dad used to always say that the most realistic depiction of police work is Barney Miller, the 70s sitcom. He's like, that's what we do. He's like, we sit around, we do paperwork most of the day. And it was really the mid-90s. It was after Rodney King. It was after the Rodney King video when I really kind of had this moment of change, because I was getting all my news at the time from MTV and Rolling Stone and Spin magazine and things like that, not from the nightly news. And it converted me. I was, you know, thinking like, there's a lot of problems with being a police officer. And I'm, you know, in the book, I write a little bit about having a conversation with my dad about the Ice-T song Cop Killer, which became this massive cultural flashpoint in 1991. And, you know, I was there trying to kind of defend Cop Killer to my dad in his squad car in the front seat. It was this moment that I'll never forget. And, you know, I didn't win the conversation, but I had been well-trained, right? I've been well-trained by watching TV talk shows, by listening to rap albums. I've been well-trained to kind of argue and to try to figure out where I stood on these kind of really important cultural conversations of the day. And I think that's true for a lot of people too. I think that's true for a lot of, you know, non-African-American folks who kind of came of age when black culture became popular culture.
Yeah. And I think that gets into a whole nother discussion about, and then at what point does it become cultural appropriation where people are taking on the culture and not crediting those who started it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, 1990 was also the year of Vanilla Ice. You know, Vanilla Ice was, you know, this guy who pure, unadulterated appropriation. I mean, you know, 10 years later, you'd see Eminem, who proudly embraced his sort of trailer roots. But Vanilla Ice was trying to, you know, put himself across as somebody who was hanging out with Luther Campbell in Miami and kind of, you know, getting in fights and on the streets and stuff. Did not go over well. But there's always that very, very fine line between, you know, and I, as a white critic who loves hip hop, have been negotiating this for 30 years, you know, and been thinking about, well, at what point, you know, does appreciation tip over into appropriation? You always have to be very, very cognizant of that, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the free speech element of all of this, What role does that play when, you know, we pride ourselves on free speech in this country, but then some people get censored?
Yeah, it's a paradox, but it's the free speech debate really did kind of ramp up in the 90s, because I do think that a lot of mainstream conservatives thought, here's an issue that we can really get behind is obscenity, vulgarity, making sure that the airwaves, the public airwaves, are safe for our kids. And, you know, you saw, you know, the Two Live Crew case really became a flashpoint in these debates. And thankfully, you know, this is the moment when hip hop won. Thinking, yes, we are, this is protected speech. It should be protected speech. But yeah, there's a huge double standard here, in terms of the kinds of things that are allowed to be, expressed, and the kinds of things that are allowed to be censored. And even what censorship means is kind of blurry too. You know, censorship is not just kind of pushing the beep button on live television, or it's not just saying, you know, I'm arresting you for saying this in a public space. Censorship can be like what happened in late 1990 to the Houston rap group, the Ghetto Boys, which is there was a CD manufacturer in Terre Haute, Indiana, that refused to duplicate the Ghetto Boys' music. They refused to produce the actual product because the owners of the duplication plant disagreed with the content on the album. And so this is what you might call kind of like supply chain censorship, right? This isn't like expressly political censorship, but this is censorship nonetheless. This is somebody who is, and so they ended up having to kind of take a couple interesting routes to getting their album out, which came out, sold a lot of copies, et cetera. But, you know, when we talk about censorship, it's, you know, just like everything that we talk about in America, censorship is racial. It's definitely racial. I mean, you can see that all the way up to 2021.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking about our present day, is there anything that we can learn from this time period that you revisited in your book, 86 to 96, with respect to the time that we're in?
You know, I think that, you know, I know that we're on the radio, so I have to kind of watch the words that I say in the book. You know, the book is very R-rated in terms of the language that's in there, because that's the language of the music. But one of the things that we saw last summer during the George Floyd protests was, and I'll abbreviate it, FTP, which yeah. was the big NWA song from their first album. And that phrase, right, not the song itself. So if you listen to NWA's version of FTP, it's not a dance song. In the book, I write extensively about how it's actually kind of a television episode, the way it's kind of set up like a court case. It's produced very impressively by Dr. Dre. But you can't dance to it. You can't kind of shout it at a protest. But there are two other songs with the exact same title, one by New Orleans rapper Lil Boozy and one by Compton rapper YG with the exact same title that were profoundly important in the on-the-ground protest movements, really since Black Lives Matter. But YG, for instance, is somebody who's really kind of taken advantage of this moment for his own kind of moral entrepreneurship. But putting out a song with that exact title, I think it's really interesting, right, to think about how that phrase that NWA kind of coined and really kind of set off this massive firestorm has slipped into the vernacular. It's slipped into the everyday language of American racial protest. And there's this one image that I saw. I think it was a journalistic photographer had taken a photo of President Trump when he and Bill Barr kind of tear gassed some protesters so Trump could go take a photo at the church. And as he's walking from where he was to the church, he's walking past a wall with spray paint all over it. Really kind of looks Berlin Wall-ish. But in that on that wall, clear as day, are the letters FTP right in front of him. And so, you know, I think this is one of the there are myriad ways that I get to in the book about how this moment kind of echoes in the current era. But I think that was one of them. I think last summer we really learned just how potent that message still is.
Mm-hmm. And I think many people now when they see those words have a certain image that comes to mind, like you said, with protest and stuff like that. So it's definitely something that's become part of our culture. Well, I want to say thank you so much, Eric. You really gave us a lot to think about and learn about, and we look forward to your book coming out this fall. Eric Harvey is an associate professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan and author of the upcoming book, Who Got the Camera? A History of Rap and Reality. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcast. Join us tomorrow for a conversation on iLearn test results in Indiana and space tourism. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.